It's April 12th. We're doing Masoret. Just for starters, questions being raised pertaining to the. I spoke a good deal about the mitzvah of rejoicing on the holiday. The Rambam talks about it in chapter 6. That. A person, take a look at if anybody has it. It's in the laws of Shvisas Yom Tov, it's called. The rest, so to speak, of the Yom Tov. And he says that the 7 days of Pesach and the 8 days of Sukkos and all the other Yom Tovs. All of them are prohibited in hesped. Hesped is eulogies and fasting, which means that if somebody died during the holiday, you're allowed to bury him. You're even allowed to bury him on the holiday itself, but we don't do it anymore because it'll lead to a lot of desecration of the holiday, which would not be permitted. So we usually wait for the Chol HaMoed, for the intermediary days. So then you bury him. But even then, you're not permitted to have any eulogies. And it's also prohibited to fast on these days. Now, the reason is, he says that V'chayev Adam Lios Behen Sameach V'Tov Lev. It's an interesting expression that a person is obligated to be on them Sameach. He should be happy. And Tov Lev, good hearted, should be in a very good mood, should rejoice. Him and his wife and his children and his household and everyone who is dependent upon him. See, already you see that the character of the joy is unique because it's not just he himself, it has to include his family. And in addition, those who sort of depend upon him. Because then he quotes the verse which says, V'samachta b'chagecha, you shall rejoice in your holiday, you and your son and your daughter and even your servants or your slaves, whatever. So, for example, when slavery was applicable, when they had Gentile slaves, but a Gentile slave is not what most people view as a slave, someone who's abused. You're not allowed to abuse the person. In fact, the person takes on the status of a certain sanctity because they're obligated in mitzvos. So they too are included. That is to say that the master must enable them to rejoice with him on the holiday. So what you see is that they too are participating in Judaism on a very significant level because they perform the mitzvos. Now, well, the obligation would seem is not on the slave per se. The obligation is on the master. I would say the reason why the obligation is on the master is because they're dependent upon him. They have the subordinate status. So whatever they're capable of doing on their own in terms of mitzvos, they do, but there may be certain things that they simply can't do. Because, or they're like the child, for example. So that's an interesting question. What about the child? We're talking about a child who's bar mitzvah? If you're talking about a child who's bar mitzvah, so then he has to keep the mitzvah, so then he's obligated to rejoice on his own. Or are we talking about a child who's not bar mitzvah? In which case, he doesn't have the obligation of rejoicing. So why is the Rambam mentioning him over here? The Rambam, by mentioning this, and without qualification, would seem to include all children. And indeed, as we go on, let's explore this a little bit. Let's explore it a little bit. He says, "Afal pisha simcha amura kan," even though the simcha that's being referred to over here is the Karban Shlamim, the so-called peace sacrifices. Well, that's another interesting concept, that the joy officially is a reference to the bringing of the sacrifices, special sacrifices. And he says, I've explained this in the laws of the sacrifices, the festival sacrifices. But nevertheless, he says, included in that, so primarily it's a reference to the joy connected to the bringing of the sacrifices. But he says included in that joy is this other dimension, that he should rejoice with his sons and B'nai and his household, each and every one in accordance with what is suitable for him. How so? Ketanim. So he's talking about children. So clearly the Rambam is talking here that the mitzvah extends to the children that are not bar mitzvah. So he says that you give them treats, nuts, and candies, whatever. The types of, in accordance with their level, whatever they like. And women, he's supposed to buy them clothing and jewelry according to what he can afford. So as I've said many times, this seems to be the only situation in the Torah where a person is obligated to buy gifts for his wife. It is before the holiday, so that she'll rejoice. And the men eat meat and drink wine. Of course, there's no simcha except with meat. And there's no simcha except with wine. So that's a very interesting concept. Then, well, let's ask the question. What about the children? The children are not obligated in mitzvos. So how do they fit into the picture? Are they obligated to rejoice or aren't they obligated to rejoice? It would seem that they're not, because this mitzvah is no different than any other mitzvah. It comes into being when you're bar mitzvah. So if so, why does the father have to facilitate that they should rejoice as well? It's also interesting, even the fact that he mentions that he has to buy gifts for the wife, but the wife is obligated to the mitzvahs herself. It's kind of like the four cups of wine or the Seder, the recitation, Sipri Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's on the wife. The mitzvah is on the wife. So here too, it's an unusual formulation. Why doesn't he simply say that everybody's obligated to rejoice, men and women? And then, but that's not the way he's formulating it. He's formulating it in a different way. As though it's not that she has the obligation, but rather he has the obligation to make her happy. But why does it work that way? Especially with regard to children, though, because with regard to children, they're not even obligated in the mitzvah. I mean, included in this is the general question, why is this so important? What's the importance of this rejoicing? Now, then he says that when he eats and drinks, he's obligated to feed the stranger. The stranger can have many significations. Technically speaking, when the Torah uses the word ger, it's a reference to a convert. But, because he's generally a ger, he's a stranger. That is, he's come from a different people. He wasn't born Jewish. So he's a newcomer to the community. But it would apply to anyone who's a stranger. I mean, you could be a Jew and be a stranger too. Even though, technically, you're never a stranger if you're a Jew, because the Jew is always regarded as your brother. But practically speaking, it doesn't always work on such an ideal level. And who else? It says the yasom is the orphan, and almana, the widow. Im sh'ar ha'aniyim ha'amelalam. And the other, with all of the people who are downtrodden people, the aniyim, generally the poor. So included in that, of course, the question is, what does it have to do with the simcha? That's a big mitzvah, obviously, to provide for those in need. But why is he connecting it with the mitzvah of simcha? Aval misha noel dalsos chatzero, but one who closes the doors of his yard, so to speak, he closes his doors, and ochel v'shosa, he eats and he drinks, him and his children and his wife, and he doesn't provide food for the poor. Ulamari nefesh, he adds another dimension here. See, it's interesting, it's not limited to one particular, the obligation here is not limited to one particular type of person. Yeah, mare nefesh means someone who's embittered, people who are embittered, unhappy. Now that could be anyone. Doesn't have to, a person could be wealthy, he could be married, and so on and so forth. Mare nefesh. But in general, it's talking about those types of people who have nothing, outcasts or whatever. He says, one who closes his door and doesn't feed these people, ein zu simchas mitzvah, this is not simchas mitzvah, the joy of the mitzvah, ela simchas kreso. But rather, he says it's the simcha of the belly. And this is, to the contrary, this is a disgusting kind of thing. He says this is degrading, this type of a meal, getting together and so it's very, very interesting. It's a very subtle distinction. If a person gets together and eats, drinks wine, and so on and so forth, it could be an exalted mitzvah, or it could be something which is just a hedonistic thing. So that's the next question. What is the giving of the charity and the gift and so forth, what does it have to do with the mitzvah of simcha? And what is the difference? What exactly is a simcha shel mitzvah? What is a simcha shel mitzvah? Okay. Now, let's continue a few more halachos, so maybe a picture will emerge. Then he says, even though eating and drinking on the holiday, on the moed, is included in the positive command, a person should not eat and drink throughout the entire day. But this is the structure. In the morning, he gets up, the entire people get up early and go to the Bate Knesios and Bate Midrashos. They go to the shuls, the synagogues, or the houses, the halls of study. Umispalin, and they daven, they pray. Bekorin b'Torah, and they read the Torah b'inyan hayom, with regard to the subject of the day. V'chozrin levatein v'yochlin, then they return home and they eat. V'holchin lebatei midrashos, and they go to the houses of study, and they read and learn until half of the day. This is the famous doctrine or formulation. Chetzia, half the day, to divide the day. Half of the day is for Hashem, for God, and half of the day is for yourself. So the rejoicing on the holiday has a certain form to it. And after Chatzi Hayom, after midday, Mispalin tefilas amincha. That's at the point at which you're supposed to daven mincha. Then chozin lebatayan, they go back to their houses. Lechol v'lishtos sharayom im halayla, to eat and drink for the rest of the day and the night. Well, that's a pretty extensive party. I don't know that it means you have to eat throughout the entire day. Generally, you go home and you eat. But the second half of the day is dedicated to your own enjoyments. Provided, of course, that they don't conflict with the laws of the Yom Tov. Then he says, Kishe Adam ochel v'shosa v'sameach b'regel, when a person eats and drinks and rejoices on the festival, Lo yimashech b'yayin, he should not get too involved with wine, pulled along too much with wine. Because it's interesting that on the one hand, you're supposed to drink wine. The Rambam has made it mandatory. To the extent that if a person refrains from wine, it would appear that he's not fulfilling the mitzvah. And of course, you have to ask why? Why is that necessary? But then he says, if you drink too much wine, it's also not fulfilling the mitzvah. He shouldn't get carried away with wine and joking and kalas rosh, frivolousness. Because that's something which is dangerous. A person starts eating and drinking and then he starts joking around and he gets completely caught up in that. So then he says, because drunkenness and frivolousness, Allah, harbe. He's not saying any kind of joking. It's one of those things where it depends. A certain amount is all right, because it produces cheerfulness. But too much is not a good thing. He says, because a lot of this, and kalas rosh, it's not a simcha. That's not really simcha. Ela holelus v'sichlus. It's a revelry, so to speak, and foolishness. So we have to be, it's very interesting how we, you know, he's sort of like chipping away. It's a very difficult concept to convey. Because what exactly is considered to be true joy? How do you differentiate it from other forms, which superficially appear to have the same characteristics? And he says we're not commanded on the revelry and foolishness, but rather on the simcha, sheyeshba avodas yotzer hakol. This is where he's kind of defining it. We were commanded pertaining to the joy, which contains within it the service of the creator of everything. Shenemar, as it says, tachas ashelo avarata es haroshem alokecha, v'simcha v'tub leva. That's a reference to the to the tochacha in Devarim, the imprecations, it's called. It's the warnings, the curses that will come upon the Jews if they abandon the Torah. And it sort of sums it up with this statement that all this is going to happen. Why? Because you failed to serve Hashem, the Lord your God. This is an amazing statement, and here you see the significance of it. That it's not just another mitzvah, but because it doesn't say because you failed to serve God. That we would understand. But you failed to serve God with joy and with a good heart. That is, you serve God. The implication is that they did serve God, they did do the mitzvahs, but they did so without joy and a good heart, which would mean they did so begrudgingly. And that alone, apparently, is sufficient to bring about all these punishments, which is an amazing concept. Halamadata, thus you learn, Shehoavoda besimcha, that avodas Hashem, the service of God, is with joy. And it's impossible to serve God in the midst of, you know, frivolousness and the jokingness and drunkenness. All right, then he goes on to certain practicalities, which I don't think we really have to go into. That is, oh, it doesn't hurt, it's one more halacha. That the Beis Din was obligated to, they appointed special officers on the festivals. And they would, it's very, very interesting. They patrol in various places, in the fields, orchards, or by the rivers. Why? Because there were picnics. People would gather and have picnics, and men and women, and they would lead to sin. So you see, even in the days of the Gemara, or before that, whatever, nothing's changed much. There's always a danger. Oh, yeah, now it's time for a holiday. People are off from work. Let's rejoice. So let's have our meals together. And let's groups of kids could go off and have parties and eat meat, drink wine. So they would have these officers. I guess today we would call them chaperones. But one thing is very, very interesting. What could you deduce from this? I just thought of something. I hadn't thought of this before. Why did they have to appoint? What? Why did they have to appoint these officers? Why didn't they just prohibit that, these gatherings altogether? Then the Chen Yasir, and they would issue warnings, proclamations, that well, then it's Kadeshlo Yisarvu, and that men and women shouldn't get together in houses for the celebration, nor that they should. Well, they warned against these types of gatherings, lest it come to Avera. What exactly then, how would we understand this? What's the difference between a Simcha Shel Mitzvah and an ordinary Simcha? We had the question pertaining to the child, that the father is obliged to see to it that the child should rejoice. And we didn't understand why that should be, because the child is not obligated in the mitzvah yet. And the question was with regard to the obligation to give out the charity and so on. But why, that's true, but why was that part of the simcha? And why is the simcha so significant? The joy is so significant that the failure to rejoice was considered the sin for which they would be deserving of all the punishments. A woman is obligated. For example, a woman's not married, then she has to rejoice on the holiday too. Interesting. A lot of people raise the question. There are people that are vegetarians and they can't eat meat, and or people that can't drink wine. It would seem, according to the way the Rambam say, quotes the Gemara, that there's no joy without meat, there's no joy without wine. That seems to be a norm. That is, on the whole, it seems to be a universal thing. I think it's pretty obvious, you know. You could, it's evident in most societies, most cultures, when they have a celebration, they have meat. Meats, fine meats, and so forth. That seems to be pretty universal. And the same is true with wine. Wine is a universal phenomenon. Virtually every cuisine, Italian food, French, the French law, virtually everybody, when they celebrate, they take out a fine wine. But if you have an individual who really is repulsed by it, for whatever reason, then it doesn't make sense to say that he has to drink it. It's not the same with regard to, say, matzah, where even if a person can't stand it, he's obligated to eat it. Because that's not a mitzvah of enjoyment. That's a mitzvah to realize, to experience on an experiential level certain ideas, to re-experience the Exodus by eating certain foods. So it doesn't matter whether you enjoy it or not. But here it's clearly connected to the concept of simcha. It enhances one's rejoicing. But if for whatever reason it's going to just make you sick, then it doesn't make sense to say that you have to eat it. But it's still, it's not regarded as being the highest level. So you eat foods that you would like, and you rejoice to the best of your ability. As he said, the Rambam said, each one according with his level. The main question is really, why is it so important to rejoice in the service of God? Most people don't look at it that way, and they would look at it as being responsibility. It's a serious thing. And even if you don't rejoice, even if you don't enjoy it, but you do it, that seems to be the way most people look at it. So what are we doing over here? Well, why are we connecting this to the, why is the element of rejoicing so important? And of course, once you say that, then you have to explain what you mean by rejoicing. For example, if people get together on the Simchas Torah, you see, they get together in the shuls and they jump and dance and sing. Is that the rejoicing in the service of God? Is that it? In many of these places, I'm just giving you my personal feeling, that in many of these places, this is my observation, I hope it's not too harsh, and maybe it's wrong, but this is my observation, that you'll find on Simchas Torah people who, I mean, they go to shul all year round, whatever it is, but they don't really put any, have much interest in Torah and Torah study and so forth. They just do it because that's the way they were raised. And yet, if comes Simchas Torah and somebody gets them going and whatever, they get into the swing and they can dance for hours. Is that a service of God? Is that what we're talking about? See, I think not, because you could bring somebody into shul who never goes to shul on Simchas Torah, and the person will get caught up in the emotions of the moment. Each person has a latent desire to get out, you know, to celebrate a little bit, provided the person is not too repressed. And there's a good beat. You could, you know, you see that happens a lot. Sometimes a person's not in the mood. You pull him in, he gets into it. And once he gets into it, he's enjoying. If something aroused his desire to sing and dance and so on and so forth, there'd be no difference between that. He could be walking down the street, and let's say there's a Greek wedding, and he just pauses to look inside. Ah, the beat and the way they're dancing, and they all look so happy. And let's say somebody were to pull him in, and he would join in. He doesn't even know these people. He could sing and dance, and would you say he's really celebrating the event? He doesn't even know the people. In the Haftorah for Parsha Shmini, which is taken from Shmuel Beis, that's the book of Samuel 2, second book, chapter 6, talks about the return of the Aron to Yerushalayim. Okay, and when they did so, there was a whole procession. I can't go into the entire background. It had been placed in the house of Obed Edom, and they brought it to the city of Ir David, to the city of David. But they had a whole procession. Whenever, as they were walking, they would, it says they walked 6 paces. And then they would slaughter an ox and then a fatter. They would bring karbano, sacrifices. So it was a whole procession. And then, but it was accompanied by tremendous dancing. It says that David danced with all his strength before Hashem. And he was girded in a linen tunic. And David and the house of Israel brought up the ark of Hashem with loud, joyous sound and the sound of the shofar. Then it says that when they arrived at the city of David, Michal, who was the daughter of Shaul, that was the former king, and David had taken over. Shaul was rejected as the king. And David was married to his daughter, Michal. And then it says that she saw King David, was dancing, leaping and dancing before Hashem. And she was contemptuous. Ativez lo beliba. She was contemptuous of him, and she was upset that he was doing this, that he was dancing like that. And then it continues with the discussion. When they finished dancing, they brought the ark to the and set it in its place, and then David blessed the people and gave out the portions, and gave them each some meat and some bread and wine, container of wine. Interesting, meat, bread, and wine. And then everybody went home. And then, when he returned to his household, says to bless his household. So Michal, the daughter of Shaul, came out to meet him, and she criticized him. Manichbay, how honored was the king of Israel today, who exposed himself today in the eyes of his servants and maidservants as one of the boors might expose himself. So she was really upset, and she lashed into him. And he answered her very harshly. And David said to Michal, "Before Hashem, who chose me over your father and his entire household to rule over the people of Hashem, did I rejoice?" And that's what he said. I played, so the visichakti doesn't just mean rejoiced. He was referring to his carrying on. He did that before Hashem. And unakalosi odmizos. And had I held myself even more lightly than this, and had I been lowly in my own eyes, and with the maidservants of whom you spoke, among them will I be honored. So she criticized him, and he responded. And then it says that Michal, the daughter of Shaul, didn't have any child until the day she died, which was apparently a punishment. But what was the dialogue over here? I think that her position was, you could look at that from a certain point of view, you could criticize, because the Rambam talks about the fact that the king has to maintain his bearing in the eyes of the people. That whenever he makes a public appearance, he's got to be with the full regalia, with the full dignity. So here it seems that he was just like one of the people, singing, dancing, jumping, and so on, carrying on. So she said that this is a violation. The king is not supposed to let his hair down in front of the people. But his answer was that that's a completely different phenomenon. Not if it's for the service of Hashem. That in the presence of God, there is no king, so to speak. And he wishes that he would have had, in other words, he gave up all of his sense of vanity and made himself completely humble before Hashem. And that's to the contrary, that's a good thing. That's a big mitzvah. That's not, even though from a visual it may appear to be the same, but it's not. Because this was completely abandonment of any type of personal vanity in this for the sake of honoring Hashem. But nevertheless, you see that this was a very significant thing. That to participate in this was extremely significant. This is a great service of God. It seems to me that, well, the Rambam describes the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, that all the Talmidei Chachamim would get together. At the end of the Laws of Sukkah in chapter 8, he says, even though it's a mitzvah, we're commanded to rejoice on all of the festivals. He says on the holiday of Sukkos, in the Mikdash, in the temple, they had an additional Simcha Yisera. And he describes how they did it. They would prepare a place in the courtyard of the temple, a place for the women above and the men below, so they shouldn't mix together. And they would begin this rejoicing on the night at the conclusion of the first days of Yom Tov, the first day. They only had one day. And then they would go every night on Chol HaMoed. They would rejoice. Interesting. For the rest of the day, after they brought the afternoon sacrifice, and throughout the night. It's hard to imagine this kind of thing. And he describes the various musical instruments. Everybody would play instruments and singing songs, and they would dance and clap and jump. Each person in accordance, I guess like a wedding, like you have at a wedding where the dancing goes on and on. And singing songs of praises to Hashem. Then he says something very interesting. It's a mitzvah to be marbe, to increase this type of simcha. So you see that simcha is very, very important. It's not a tangential thing. But then he says something interesting. He says that this was not done by the ordinary people, or v'chol mi sheyirtze, or anyone who wanted to. Ela gedolei chachmei Yisrael. This was reserved for, I guess you might use the word elites, special kind of elite, the great Torah sages, and the heads of yeshivos, and Sanhedrin, and pious people, and elders, and people of deeds. In other words, all these renowned people who were very pious and very learned, what we would call tzaddikim, righteous people. They're the ones that danced and clapped and played music and rejoiced in the Mikdash on the Sukkos. But the rest of the folks, the rest of the people, men and women, they would come to see and hear. Now that's very, very interesting. What is that? What do we learn from that point? Then he says that the simcha, the joy, that a person rejoices in the doing of the mitzvos and in the love of God who commanded them, is a great service. And whoever holds himself back from this joy, it's fitting to be punished. That person deserves to be punished. Very, very interesting. The person deserves to be punished, as it says, because, he quotes that pasuk, because they didn't serve God with joy and a good heart. And whoever is vain, who holds himself aloof, and he, you know, he can't let his hair down, so to speak. That's the whole issue with, that's what he quotes. He quotes the thing we just read about David. That if a person is haughty, he's like too proud, and he guards his own honor, and he can't let, you know, he stands aloof. He considers it to be beneath him to join in. This person is a sinner and a fool. Why? He quotes the verse from Mishlei. Shlomo warned, Al tishadar, don't glorify yourself before the king. That this is not the appropriate situation. In the presence of God, there's no personal ego at all. The person has to be completely humble. And to the contrary, whoever lowers himself and removes any type of pride in these types of situations, because there are situations where you shouldn't do this. You have to differentiate. There are situations where you have to maintain your place, your pride, your dignity, so to speak. He says whoever lowers himself, he is the one who is great, who is honored, who serves out of love, who serves out of love. And so too, David, the king of Israel, said, Unukalosi od mizos. Would that I would lower myself, make myself even smaller than this, and be even more lowly in my own eyes. So he says that the greatness and the honor is only lismoach, again, true greatness and true honor is to rejoice before God. And it says the King David would jump and dance before God. Now it seems to me that the question I raised before, you take a person off the street, bring him in on Simchas Torah, and he gets into the spirit of things, the beat and everything, and he dances. I don't think that's, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong about doing that, but I don't think that's really the, what he's feeling is the true Simcha. You've aroused certain emotions that just happen to be, it could be, if it was a gospel choir in a church, he would be jumping with them too. It's not. It's just that each person has certain latent emotions that can be aroused, and he has a good time. That's not the service of God. And that's why you had this phenomenon that the only ones that could participate were these people. What did they all have in common? These sages and heads of yeshivos and Sanhedrin, and the people of Maisa, people who did great deeds, means that these were people who partook of that way of life, of the good. But more than just the good, I think that the ultimate ideal of Simcha is because the ultimate level is really to serve Hashem with love, is Ahavas Hashem. That the real good in Judaism, if a person merely serves Hashem because of fear, he serves out of fear, then and it's a responsibility, and he has no choice, and he has to do it, and he's afraid of the consequences, that is not the true service of God. That's not the purpose, because he views, it's a complete distortion. It's a complete distortion of the whole system. He can't attribute any real value to the system. It's really an encumbrance. It's a pain. And he has to do it because otherwise he's going to be punished. That's the service of fear. And of course it has to involve a complete distortion of his relationship to God. He views God as, I don't know how he, what he projects onto God. That God will be angry with him. So it's a very primitive level of the service of God, even if it's meticulous, but it doesn't have the capability of bringing about that development within the person. It's supposed to fulfill the person, to develop his soul, to completely transform the person into someone who really perceives the good and loves the good. Now, given the way man is constructed, if he should be able to partake of that goodness of the Torah, and the joy that one has when he's operating in line with the will of the Creator, and he's not living in accordance with his instincts and emotions, but he realizes that he's doing such a good for himself, it has to produce joy. What we see from this is that the appropriate service of God, if a person is going in the right pathway, of course this takes a tremendous amount of effort and time and so on and so forth, it doesn't come easy, but nevertheless the Torah demands that we partake of it to the greatest extent possible, and to do so he's responsible. That's why you see, even for the child, I would compare to the people who I gathered. The people had to come to see. Why'd they have to come and see? They couldn't participate. Because from observing and not participating, they recognize this principle. That those who are truly immersed in the service of God experience the greatest joy. Then they can reflect on their own lives and why they're not experiencing anything akin to that. And then they know what it should change, the goal, what the goal truly is. So that's why he has to include everybody. He has a responsibility. The one who has achieved the level of Ahava, of love, has a responsibility to others. Not just to see to it that they can do the mitzvah, but to teach them the idea that the service of God is one which produces great joy. That a person has to cultivate, on whatever level he can, the phenomenon, the love of God. But he has to allow himself to experience it also. Which means he has to have the experience. And he can't allow any of his petty emotions of vanity to stand in the way. He has to fight against that. Because if he doesn't allow himself to experience it, then it's dormant. He may have the capability of experiencing it, but it's got to be brought forth. That's the idea of the Chag. One of the ideas of the Chag, then, is to establish the idea that ultimately the objective of Judaism is Ahavas Hashem, is love of God, which, if it's to the extent that a person can partake of it, will experience tremendous joy. And as I said, if a person is not experiencing the joy, then there's something wrong. Now, that doesn't mean that he should feel bad about himself, but he should be cognizant of it. As I said, it's not easily acquired. There are many other factors in life that can interfere with it. But he has to be cognizant of that, and that has to be his goal. He has to strive. So Yom Tov is a time which is set aside for him to be able to experience that type of joy. That now we understand why he has to include. He's got to include those for whom he has a responsibility. The wife, the children, and then the slaves, because this is something which he has to set. You see that it's the kind of thing that those who are on the level where they can partake of it have to set an example and have to facilitate this for others. That's why the Rambam makes a very, very clear distinction between something which may feel the same. A person can be dancing, but that dancing is not the service of God. He can be rejoicing, but he can be rejoicing purely because of some emotions have been aroused within him. Those are the people that dance on Simchas Torah. They're not feeling any love of Torah. However, people who study the Torah and derive great enjoyment from it, and they see the real beauty of it, when they put themselves in the right spirit, they call to mind, they think about what the Torah means to them, then they rejoice, they make a whole celebration, they're celebrating that event. It's like someone who just happened to come into a wedding, for whatever reason they're there. You invited today. You invited someone to a wedding, and you tell them they could bring a date, and they brought the date. The date doesn't even know the person. Yeah, but they could start singing and dancing just because a wedding brings that. As opposed to someone who's very close to the bride and groom, that person is dancing and celebrating the event because they're connected to the phenomenon. See, that's why he says that the person in this situation who closes himself off from consideration, from concern about the widow, the Mari Nefesh, the person who truly has Avas Hashem feels bad for all of these people. Like Avram Avinu has a sympathy and he wants them to be happy. That's what the Rambam describes, Avas Hashem. That the one who loves God, the mitzvah is that to cause God to be beloved. So it means a certain attitude towards people as well. A certain appreciation. And you want to share this with others. You want others to partake of this good as well. You want to get other people involved. That's part and parcel of the Avas Hashem. A person who has a genuine Avas Hashem, a love of God, automatically has a different attitude towards people and wants to share it with people. Wants them to be able to experience it. So if before the Chag, he closes his door and just holds up with his family, he's just using this as an excuse. He's using it as an excuse. So that's why you have all these different factors that it's necessary to eat meat and drink wine, because celebration and joy, we're physical beings. And in order to celebrate, we need certain physical things that enhance the celebration. But that's why he says it should not be the wine that's bringing it. That's why. So joking is okay. Do a little joking. That too is part of the mood. A person wants to put himself in a certain kind of a mood where he's extremely happy. So the meat, the wine, even joking. But you got to be very, very careful, because you can allow yourself to be taken over by one of those elements. If you allow yourself to be taken over by one of those elements, then it changes the entire. A person can be very coarse as well. It's a fine line. It's a fine line between getting together and having sometimes at a Seder. That's why the learning is exceedingly important. It's like at a Seder. If you have a really good Seder, you have some really good discussion, and then you drink some wine, and you're in a certain frame of mind. Whatever the frame of mind is, and then you start to rejoice, but you're rejoicing with that frame of mind. If it's a different frame of mind, you've just been talking about any kind of nonsense, this and that, which doesn't elevate the person. So that's a different mood. And then when he drinks the wine, that's a different type of celebration. It's very, very subtle. It's very subtle. But that, I think, is an extremely, extremely important idea. It has to be approached very carefully. A person has to know himself, he has to know his level, And he has to know what he's capable of, where he stands. That's why you see that there were people that participated in the dancing. Then there were people who just watched. They realized they were not on that level. They could not experience that joy at this point in time. Yeah, but there's nothing, when you see other people, there's just a natural emotion that people have. When you see other people having a really good time, you'll see people will stop and they'll want to see, observe a wedding, how people are really having a good time. Because that's something that everybody longs for and yearns for. It's built into our nature. Everybody wants to experience that joy, except that we haven't found what it is in life that will give it to us. But the answer is it's the Torah. And if the Torah is approached correctly and not through the... I think the great significance over here is that it's completely opposed to the idea of serving out of fear. And it's based upon... That's why... The punishment, the person deserves to be punished. Because by operating this way, he's preventing this ideal, the ideal of Ahava. And he's steeped in the whole idea of fear. But that's not the correct idea. It's not fitting. It's not appropriate for a person to serve God out of fear. That, as the Rambam said, that's for children and beginners and so forth, because you need a starting point. But that cannot be elevated to the level of being the philosophy. Philosophy has to be that the goal is to serve God out of love. It's not easy either, by the way. But and a lot of people will talk about this, pay lip service to it, but to go from there, how do we attain it? What is the appropriate approach to Judaism that enables us to attain it? See, that's why I think it's a big problem. Because I think what happens is that people think if you get together on Friday night, like you have these Kalbach minions that I was talking about recently. So people come to shul and you'll start to sing and maybe even dance. And look, they're all singing and dancing. So now they're celebrating Shabbos. That's not what it is, in my opinion. Because the source of the joy is extraneous. You're just connecting it to the day of the Shabbos. But it's not the character of the joy itself. That's not something which can come from extraneous stimulation. There's got to be a certain way of observing Judaism that leads to that. And that's not so simple. The reason why the father or the head of the house wants to do it is because, true, it's part of his own joy to celebrate together with his family. But it's not just his family. I think it also contains the notion that this is the kind of joy that demands to be shared. Because part of his love, since it's rooted in love of God by its very nature requires that a person share it with others. That's the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvos, to cause God to be beloved. Whenever you found this tremendous love object, you have to tell people about it. It's something that you want others to appreciate, to recognize, just like you do. So it's both of those things.